Welcome to the Florida Roundup, statewide edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, Greek life at FSU is quiet this weekend. No official fraternity or sorority parties. What a change, Tom.
Just a week ago,
20-year-old Andrew Coffey of Lighthouse Point was found unresponsive after going to an off-campus party the night before. Andrew was a Pi Kappa Phi pledge. In the wake of his death on Monday, FSU President John Thrasher suspended all 54 Greek organizations on campus.
The safety and the well-being of our students will always be my number one priority, and that's why I'm enacting several changes effective immediately. I'm imposing an indefinite interim suspension on all fraternities and sororities at FSU.
The Pi Kappa Phi chapter at FSU has been in trouble in the past, Melissa, in trouble for hazing, misconduct, and violating policies about alcohol, according to its national chapter. Now, about one out of every five undergrads at FSU belong to a fraternity or sorority. All of those fraternities and sororities are suspended, as we mentioned. Amy Hecht is FSU Vice President of Student Affairs.
They will not be able to meet as chapter or as councils without our participation. For those that still have initiations that are necessary, they would only be able to do so if someone from their national organization is there to participate along with them.
Now, FSU is not alone in this Greek suspension, Melissa. It's at least the third campus this year to suspend Greek life after the death of pledges. Penn State and Louisiana State did the same earlier this year. Now, those bans in Pennsylvania and Louisiana have since been lifted, though.
That's right. We want everyone listening, let us know what you think of President Thrasher's decision in Tallahassee. Are you an FSU parent? Do you support this ban on Greek life on the campus? Are you an FSU alum? Does it affect your support for the school? Give us a call from anywhere on the state, 305-995-1800. We're discussing the FSU Greek ban here on the Florida Roundup as we welcome Joe Reedy. He covers FSU and Florida government for the Associated Press. And on the line from Boston, John Heckinger of Bloomberg News and the author of the new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities. Joe, let's begin with you. Such a big step. Why did Thrasher go so far, do you think, as to choose to suspend all Greek activities on the campus?
Well, I think President Thrasher looked at the cases with Penn State and Louisiana State, and besides the death of Andrew Coffey, which also occurred on Parents' Weekend, there's been a drug case involving another fraternity where there's been two arrests. So I think this history of behavior and past suspensions that haven't worked with individual fraternities and sororities, he wants a new discussion to take place with everyone and a new way to bring Greek life on campus under more reformed rules.
And what's he calling for specifically? The suspension is pretty absolute, isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty absolute at the moment. The next weekend is homecoming here at Florida State, which for mid to late November, it's rather late. It won't have much an effect on the homecoming parade. I think out of the 70 floats, 10 were fraternities and sororities. But I think when you look nationally with alcohol-related cases among fraternities and sororities, and maybe bringing it more under control of the university instead of Greek councils, which are largely governed by students. I think he wants more oversight by the university so that hazing cases like this don't happen again.
Joe, it's Tom Hudson. President Thrasher talked about ending the suspension when there's a new normal. What do you think he means by that?
I think new normal as far as parties at fraternities and sororities, maybe more legislations like what you see under off-campus and on-campus bars as far as maybe IDing and making sure that no underage drinking takes place. I think we've seen in hazing cases in the past, not just fraternities and sororities, more discipline as far as that. And this case too goes to student organizations where alcohol is banned from them. So for example, if intramurals wanted to have an end of the season banquet or something, alcohol wouldn't be served. So I think it with alcohol and, you know, drug use on campus, I think this is a big concern of President Thrasher and trying to get the conversation going in that direction.
Joe, while Greek life has been suspended, does that mean that fraternity brothers and sorority sisters have to move out of their homes?
No, they don't have to move out of their homes. They can still live in the homes. The meal plans that they bought still are in effect as far as that. But as far as any chapter meetings, any chapter functions, those cannot take place at the moment. So your fraternity and sorority houses are basically dorms where no other activities can take place.
Pretty quiet neighborhoods now, yeah.
Yeah, and if you're just tuning in, it's the Florida Roundup. Our look at the biggest stories from the week all across the Sunshine State. You can join us, connect from anywhere in Florida by calling 305-995-1800. This is our question to callers right now. What do you think of the Greek ban on the Florida State campus? Think it was the right decision? Give us a call. And John Hechinger, your new book, True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities, looks into the, you know, the wider culture of fraternities around the country and why these types of tragedies tend to happen. In the book, you mention what you call the unholy trinity of fraternity culture. Can you describe that, the unholy trinity that you find over and over again in frat houses?
Well, I'm talking in the book about drinking, misogyny, and racism. And you see these issues happen again and again. And drinking and hazing are intimately related. One of the reasons why hazing is so deadly at fraternities is that it tends to be related to forced drinking, asking people to drink until they pass out. So this is a problem throughout fraternity culture, and until someone puts a stop to it, until the fraternities themselves sign on to these reform measures, it's not going to change.
One of the reform measures you advocate in the book is an obvious one, limiting alcohol among the students. Easier said than done, though, right?
That's right. It's tough to do, but I mean, there are drinking laws, and it's widely known on campus that these parties are flouting the drinking laws. And research is very clear that fraternity men drink more heavily than any other group on campus, something like twice as much. So if colleges are serious about underage drinking, they're going to have to crack down on drinking at the chapter houses. And they'll find that there are some national fraternities that would actually welcome this, that would like their chapters to be dry. I think they could make some progress there.
Hmm. And it's the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Let's go to Cindy in Davie right now. Hi, Cindy. Thanks for calling the show. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I am a faculty member at a local university. I was Greek when I was an undergraduate. And after reading the very extensive article, I believe it was in the New Yorker, about the death of the Penn State student, I was horrified, and it's stayed with me ever since. I commend the FSU president for taking this measure. Students need to take this seriously and realize that somebody's life and the things that they're doing actually go against the principles that are put forth in their national charters. That Greek life is supposed to enhance you as a citizen and, like, support the principles that make us all better people in the world, not challenge you in beer pong. So I commend the president for what he's done, and I hope these guys take it seriously. And I hope that they have to do something in order to be readmitted, that the suspension isn't just lifted, but maybe that they have to, you know, reinforce their national principles, submit critical thinking projects on how they're going to address these issues. You know, because it's not just one fraternity. We all know that.
Cindy, let me ask you quickly. You mentioned you're a faculty member. The institution you're at, does it have a Greek program?
No, we don't have a Greek program.
It doesn't. Okay. Cindy, thanks for your call. I want to follow up with something Cindy's talking about there. And John, you had mentioned it. What role do the national chapters have in this? In this case, at Florida State, the school president took this action. But could a chapter... kind of the national chapter revoke you know, its Greek letters from a house because it wants to be dry or for some other issue.
Absolutely, and it happens all the time. I mean, my book focuses on Sigma Alpha Epsilon, which is one of the largest fraternities, and they've shut down something like 30 chapters over the last 5 years because they wanted to enforce their policy of eliminating pledging entirely. That's the period when these very brutal initiations take place. So they when they find that there's evidence of hazing, they do shut down the chapters. Now, the national fraternities usually are just, you know, several dozen people.
Yeah.
So they rely on the colleges as well to enforce the rules.
And I guess my question, John, is less about, you know, taking that kind of punitive action after a tragedy like this. But you mentioned, you know, maybe that some houses could become dry and that there's no alcohol. You know, we know of colleges and universities, for instance, that sororities have a no alcohol ban at sorority homes, but it's not the same at fraternities. So I guess my question is, could the national chapters decide to take that kind of action?
Absolutely. I mean, the best example is Phi Delta Theta, which in 2000 said that all of its chapters would be dry. Mm. And they had had multiple deaths in the years prior, and actually, up until LSU, they hadn't had a single other death, and their accidents and injuries and sexual assaults went way down. So it's possible. Sig Ep, another big fraternity, has recently decided that it's going to institute a ban in alcohol in its chapters. So,
and,
yes, it can be done.
It can be done. And calls coming in from across the state as we talk about the decision at Florida State to ban Greek life after a student's death. What do you think? 305-995-1800. Liz in Jacksonville. Hello, Liz. You're on the show.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say I've got a daughter at FSU, and I am so happy that President Thrasher took this action, because it's it seems to me like it's been a long, sustained pattern of you know, abuse, drinking, and that's not what we send our kids to college for. We send them there to get an education. We don't want, you know, they're young, impressionable, and we don't want them started off on this path when they are so malleable.
So yeah, you're
so
in support
absolutely
of it.
In support.
In support. Liz,
yeah,
thanks for that. And Joe Reedy, what's the reaction been? You cover Florida State. There's been backlash, I take it, among some alumni groups. But as you're covering this, what's the sense? Is President Thrasher getting cover from the board of the school and from alumni groups? Are people standing behind him with this decision?
I think they are right now, because the fall semester only lasts for another month, I think. The further this goes along, who knows how much cover he will get. I will add, though, that President Thrasher has been very popular after coming in with some concerns from alumni and other groups, because he wasn't an educator. He was a former Senate president, but in his first couple years, he's really turned around. The faculty is very heavily behind him. He has done a lot for them and for other groups, so he is a very popular president. I think also one other reform that he might be looking at, not a lot of campuses do it. You go on the Greek Life page for Florida State, and it's a nice little recruitment piece and for everybody, but I think maybe colleges and universities, and maybe Florida State might be the first to do this, is if there is a alcohol or sexual assault case, the university police or Tallahassee police or Leon County Sheriff's has done, if there is a reporting statistics thing on that Greek Life page so that parents and students can take a look at that and know just before pledging to a fraternity or sorority if those organizations have been in trouble before.
Sure.
That would
quickly
be some kind of transparency.
Yes. And I'm wondering too, Joe, if he's getting any blowback from alumni who might be saying, look, Greek life is important in terms of my son or daughter learning about philanthropy, and it's an important part of their networking and future. Any of that chatter at all?
I think there is a little bit, because I think especially among sororities, they are going, you know, most of these cases happen with fraternities, so why are we being punished, you know, the actions of a few impacting the whole? But I think once meetings between the administration and these groups begin to take place, and there is a dialogue about the best way to approach things, there, I think there'll be a lot more communication that way. But I think right now you got a lot of groups that are waiting to see what happens next. I do know among the fraternities and sororities, though, the national chapters have told those at Florida State that they didn't want any comment, especially Monday being on campus and going among a couple fraternity houses. There was no comments at all.
Let's squeeze in one more call here from Pinecrest in Dade County. Rodrigo, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, how are you? And thanks for the program. I wanted to share my experience. I went to FSU Tallahassee last weekend to visit my daughter, who's a student there, and she's in a sorority and enjoying very much that experience. But I also, what I noticed in the city, which is a state capital, is that there are a lot of excessive freedom, I would say, like freedom to get access to alcohol for underage kids. And I saw that in open locals and public, like bars and that kind. My daughter told me that to get a fake ID takes $30. Mm. I've heard from programs during this week that the state legislators are also being in trouble for their low morale. So I think there's a larger problem here.
Rodrigo, we get it. We're going to talk about the culture in the state legislature coming up in the next segment. John Hechinger, let me ask you kind of about some of the concerns that Rodrigo talks about, is the broader influence on campus and how that spills over and perhaps influences some of this behavior in Greek life.
Well, that's certainly true. And, you know, one of the ways that colleges can influence that culture is by enforcement and cracking down. In the book I write about the University of Rhode Island, which was called the number one party school for years, and its president decided to crack down on fraternities, to eliminate alcohol at all school functions, and to enlist the local police to make sure that the bars were following the rules and the drinking didn't happen off campus. And it was studied pretty rigorously, and alcohol-related hospitalizations declined, and it's no longer at the top of that list. So, you know, if people are serious about this, change could happen.
John Hechinger with us here on the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition, Bloomberg News author of True Gentlemen, The Broken Pledge of America's Fraternities, talking about the suspension of Greek life at Florida State University. John, thanks for your time today. Joe Reedy also along with us from the Associated Press from Tallahassee, where he covers FSU and Florida government for the AP. You are listening to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition from Florida Public Radio. More after this.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. This week, Melissa, it's been a week now, actually, today on this Friday, since Republican State Senator Jack Latvala has been anonymously accused of sexual harassment and groping, those accusations leveled against the state senator by six women. He has since canceled several public appearances in the past week in his campaign for governor. And, you know, he also stepped down under pressure from his position as chairman of the Senate Budget Committee.
That's right, Tom. Latvala, of course, just the latest in a string of men all over the country who has been accused of this kind of behavior. The Senate has also launched an investigation into the claims. Latvala took a lie detector test this week with his legal team. It was conducted by the retired chief polygraph examiner for the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. And in a sworn statement, he has denied the accusations against him, first reported by Politico Florida last Friday.
And these allegations are probably the most explosive part of the story of sex, consensual, and harassment that has been surfacing in and around the state legislature in recent weeks here. A Democratic state senator quit after admitting to an extramarital affair with the lobbyists. So is there a toxic culture of behavior among lawmakers in Tallahassee? Does the legislature do enough to root out harassment? Let us know statewide, 305-995-1800 here on the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. Representative Kristen Jacobs is with us. She represents part of Broward County and also wants a task force to look at sexual harassment in the legislative process. Representative Jacobs, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What do you want your task force to accomplish?
Well, hello, and thank you for having me on the show. It's good to be back. The task force was a conversation with Senator Lauren Book and I, who also represents parts of Broward County, to really look at the culture of sexual harassment that runs rampant in the Capitol. So while some efforts were taken, and kudos to Speaker Corcoran last year, a year ahead of the curve, to look at these issues as related to his chambers, we really haven't had a comprehensive look at all offices that are under state control. And so what we wanted to do in our task force was really to offer options for women, both for those that may want to come forward and share information or share what's happened to them, or those who, in fact, don't want to and are just not able to or willing to take that last step to identify who it is, but still want some measure of control over, you know, their lives and what is it they do, how do they move forward through their job. There's a lot of other options other than just stepping forward. So it's our hope, amongst other things, that the task force will come forward with a series of recommendations that include not only those two issues, but others as well.
Representative Jacobs, you said that harassment runs rampant. What do you mean by that? Explain that.
You know, I can tell you personally, from having arrived there in 2014 as a freshman legislator, but also as a grandmother who had been in politics at that point for over 16 years, I was really stunned at the things that happened to me. And in talking to others, when I finally braved the subject, the response back was either, oh, he's harmless, or in one case, oh, everyone knows not to close that person's door, or allow that person to close the door in their office. And I just was so frustrated that it's not okay, and how do I deal with this? Who do I talk to? And thinking in many cases it was me, and it was not me, but I was alone in this. But of course it turns out that it's quite rampant. And so if you are a young intern from one of the local colleges that is working in the Capitol, or you're a lobbyist, or you're a female legislator or aide, since all of this started to come out, I can tell you the stories I've heard from so many women coming forward, it's quite remarkable that it is a culture of power and harassment that goes far beyond anything most of us have experienced in normal corporate life.
And the floodgates have opened as women across the country share stories of harassment and abuse, sometimes sexual assault, sometimes rape. We want to know what you think about this as we're learning about this toxic culture in Tallahassee, the state capital. The number to share your thoughts on the Florida Roundup statewide, 305-995-1800. Steve Bosque, Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief, is also on the show with us. And Steve, you've written a lot in recent days about this culture in the Capitol. Just incredible eye-popping details about lobbyists bringing in young women, scantily clad women, to help close deals, at watering holes around town in Tallahassee, that this is just sort of an accepted part of the culture. It's tough to change a well-entrenched culture, even when it's obvious that it needs to change. As legislators talk about trying to file proposals like Representative Jacobs to criminalize some of this behavior, how difficult do you think this might be to kind of move the culture in the Capitol in a more positive direction?
Well, a couple of things, and thanks for having me on. First of all, this legislature institutionally has a poor track record at policing itself for ethical transgressions, things like that. It just doesn't like to turn a mirror on itself and doesn't do a very good job of it. This, however, is very serious stuff that we're talking about. I don't want to give listeners the impression that this is everyone's way of doing business in Tallahassee. It really isn't. That would be unfair to the vast majority of people in the legislature who I think behave themselves. Having said that, however, Joe Negron, the Senate president, is facing a huge challenge here because the session's going to begin in a few weeks, and they want to get to the bottom of these anonymous allegations against Jack Latvala and resolve them, but do it in a way that is fair to all concerned and doesn't make it seem like they're sweeping anything under the rug. That would only make things worse. This controversy has the potential to be highly destructive to the reputation of the Florida legislature and its credibility. So they need to get a handle on this thing very quickly.
Let me note, too, that Democratic Senator Audrey Gibson of Jacksonville is replacing Jeff Clemons as Senate Minority Leader in 2018 as a fallout from this burgeoning scandal. Let's listen quickly to Senator Gibson.
We don't have that right now, Melissa.
Okay, but Clemons resigned late last month after Politico Florida reported that he had an affair with a lobbyist. And we are also, newsflash, just crossing. At the national level, comedian Louis C.K., one of many national male figures who's been caught up in this, he has just apologized for sexual misconduct he's been accused of, saying in a statement that the stories women are telling about him are true. You know, at this point, it's almost as though you kind of say, which celebrity isn't being accused? you know what I'm saying? But Steve, you know, what about the fact that Attorney General Pam Bondi is saying that the women that have accused Senator Latvala need to identify themselves and come forward? As of right now, they are remaining anonymous.
Right. Well, yes, that was Pam Bondi on Tuesday after a cabinet meeting saying that, you know, the right to face your accuser is a bedrock principle in this country. Now, having said that, they also want to they've assured the confidentiality the Senate has of women complainants. Everyone knows the sense of intimidation, shame, other emotions that people that explain why women are reluctant to come forward in these situations, and that may be particularly true in a highly politically charged atmosphere where the men who are targets of the complaints are the most powerful people here. They've got access to not just political influence, but money, power, everything. So navigating that's not going to be easy. Bondi was very emphatic. She said that these women, quote, they have to come forward. I think there's a hope here and an expectation that this, as my colleague Mary Ellen Kloss and I called it in a story the other day, the code of silence that's existed in Tallahassee for too long, where people talk about this conduct in whispered tones, but no one ever goes on the record about it, that has to change.
Steve, you heard from Representative Jacobs, and we'll hear from her again, talking about those whispered tones that she encountered as a freshman lawmaker not that long ago. Is that code beginning to crack?
It is. It is beginning to. I've known Kristen Jacobs for a long time, by the way, from my days in South Florida. Mm-hmm. I would like, you know, she served in local government in Broward County. One of the things we need to be talking about here is what makes Tallahassee peculiar from county government in Miami-Dade or Broward, where you don't hear these kinds of stories and this kind of behavior. And it has to do with the geographic isolation people have from their families, their loved ones, and things start to happen. You've also got older, powerful men and younger, attractive women in a very politically charged atmosphere.
Representative Kristen Jacobs back with us. Criminalizing behavior that has long been looked at as wink, wink, nod, nod behavior. That's clearly the mandate that you're going to be pursuing. This will be challenging, though, not something that can be done overnight. Can you tell us the next steps for you and your colleagues as you try to establish this task force, who you might be appointing to the task force, for example?
Absolutely. I think, first of all, we're kind of taking a two-pronged approach. One is through the creation of a task force that will send back recommendations that are based on consensus to come forward and bring forth other ideas. And if we have time, I'd like to talk to you about some of those things I'm hoping the task force will address, including the ones we've already talked about. But there's also, when you become an elected official, there is a line in state statute under Section 6 that talks about misuse of public position. And so what it does is it talks about corruptly using your influence to benefit yourself or your personal, you know, your bottom line financial status. But it doesn't talk about sexual harassment. So it is a simple change to add language in Section 6. That's one of the other things that Senator Book and I are looking at. I can't give you the language right now. We are it is in drafting, and so basically it would take the definition of sexual harassment in the workplace and add that as one of the issues under Section 6 for misuse of public position.
So that's a start. And your colleague in this, Lauren Book, she, correct me if I'm wrong, she's a survivor of sexual abuse herself, correct?
Yes, she was as a child by her nanny for many years.
And so this issue has become so widespread, going beyond the Capitol. It's incredible the tipping point we've reached as a culture where people have felt empowered to speak out publicly about this. Do you feel that political capital at your back as you work on this issue?
You know, that is such a great question because I don't. And I think that
you don't.
There are, for example, I really don't. I think that there's a lot of attention being made now to creating an environment that will offer safety for that woman that can come forward, or man, this is happening to men as well, that will have the ability to come forward and know that their job or their position is not going to be in jeopardy. But I would tell you that even with those safeguards, as you're watching some of the people, some of the issues unfolding right now in Tallahassee, that safety net is very small, and in fact, because it is in doubt, many, many women, and I don't know the actual number, but I would say it's upwards of 90%, who experience sexual harassment in the workplace simply do not come forward. So I think we need to do a lot more. That is not just that the only option you have is to go tell, but that what else can you do? What about personal empowerment? What things can you say to the person who has done these things to you? What is it that if you are a person?
Yes, well, yeah, and let me just jump in. And yes, and as we continue the conversation, you are listening to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you. So if someone confides in you, what can you do? What should you do? And then for personal protection, if it's physical, there's ways that we, I think, as women could be empowered physically to deal with the change. And one woman in particular told me about an incident, and I said, well, what did you do? And she said, I punched him. And I thought, how interesting that a woman felt that strong that she could do that, right? I don't think most of us do. And so I think, short of that, there are other options out there. And so it's the hope that the task force comes forward with a series of opportunities for workshops for women to learn more about what we can do without having to make it super public. What are the things and options that are at our disposal? And then finally, most of the counties have an inspector general office that was created by the legislature, I believe, in 2010. It's an independent arm that was created by the state, but it is funded by the counties. Broward County has one in place. The voters approved it in, I think, 2011. So the idea that the inspector general might offer the ability for a third-party investigative counseling arm, that inspector general position and all of his staff only look at elected officials, both, I shouldn't say only, it's Broward County elected officials, whether they are county or city, and anyone involved in any company that has a procurement involvement with the cities or counties. So it's quite a broad net of authority that he has, and I think that it might be another opportunity for helping give women some measure, somewhere to turn.
Representative Jacobs, let me bring Steve Bousquet back into the conversation. You know, Steve is a longtime reporter. He's obviously covered Tallahassee for a good long time as well. Steve, with Representative Jacobs and Senator Book organizing this task force, two Democratic lawmakers in the minority party in Tallahassee, what are the political realities that any of the recommendations that they may have out of this task force are going to encounter?
I would say ordinarily, in a Republican-dominated legislature, Democratic ideas, Democratic proposals, don't go very far. This is likely to be the exception to the rule. We have to talk pragmatically here. Mm-hmm. We're going into an election year where most people in the legislature are going to face the voters. As you both have noted repeatedly here in this segment, this issue has gotten and is going to continue to get an amazing amount of traction in the media nationally because of Harvey Weinstein and the other both entertainment and media people and the comedian who's just been exposed on the front page of the New York Times and elsewhere. And so the worst possible thing, and this is a male-dominated political culture up here, legislature, the worst thing they could do, they know this, is to turn a blind eye to reasonable proposals to deal with this. So the Florida legislature faced a sexual harassment scandal 26 years ago after a secret payment was made, in effect, hush money, to a staffer to an attempt to conceal allegations of sexual harassment. The story got out. The media uncovered it and reported it. And, changes were made and life went on. And here we are 26 years later, and we're having the discussion again. But this time, I think people like Lauren Book and Kristen Jacobs and many others need to be pressing this issue vigorously, and it'll get the attention it deserves, I think.
Kristen Jacobs, one last question. Could this sweep a few more women into power in Tallahassee, in male-dominated Tallahassee, very quickly?
It may sweep in. I would just also want to offer that the Speaker's office has already reached out to me, and I know the President to Senator Book, offering their support in moving this legislation forward. They are all in.
Well, this is certainly something that has dominated our cultural and political discussion, not just in Florida, but all over the country. As we just saw a few minutes ago, you mentioned it, Steve, the comedian Louis C.K. just apologized for and confirmed the allegations that have been made against him. And so we'll continue to follow it here on the show. In the meantime, thank you both so much for joining us. Representative Kristen Jacobs, she represents parts of Broward County. Steve Boske, Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief. This is just an issue that we're fascinated with. Thank you both so much for being with us. We appreciate it. In a moment, Dan Rather on his new book, looking at unity and patriotism. This is the Florida Roundup. Keep listening.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup Statewide Edition. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, at a deeply polarizing time in this nation's history, iconic journalist Dan Rather has emerged as a voice of reason and integrity. Tommy's just been writing so passionately about what it means to be an American.
And he's been writing in a 21st century platform. After decades in television broadcasting, of course, Rather has found a brand new following, millions of folks online with social media tracking his posts in the state of the nation. He's out with a new collection of original essays reminding us of the principles upon which the United States was founded.
Dan Rather joins us now with a look inside that new book co-written with journalist Elliot Kirshner. It's called What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan Rather, a pleasure. Thanks for being on the Florida Roundup.
Well, great to be with you, Melissa and Tom. Thank you very much for your time.
Oh, we so appreciate your time and so much to talk about inside the pages of your new book. But I'd like to begin first by noting, as Tom said, this book is made possible in part by your incredible social media following you've built in the years since you left CBS News. What's that been like for you, and did it take you by surprise?
It took me by complete surprise. I've been away from CBS News for 12 years. I've continued to work full-time for, among other people, Mark Cuban, who's an entrepreneur out of Dallas, on his Axis TV channel, which is a cable and satellite channel. But this surprised me, and I do want to say I'm very grateful for it. I had no idea that we could reach this many people on social media. I'm still, frankly, in awe of it, but I do appreciate it very much. And my experience on my Facebook page and then another Facebook page, which we call News and Guts, which deals with news of the day, encouraged me to start thinking about a book. But you know, What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism, is not a screed about the Trump administration. In fact, President Trump has not even mentioned it. But we all know we're in a particularly divisive time in the country. And it's a perilous time for the country in many ways, a dangerous time, one of the more dangerous times we've had during my lifetime. But if I can bring anything, and I'm not sure I can, I am humble about things. I know humility is not a word normally associated with present or past television anchor people, but nonetheless, I'm not an expert on anything, much less patriotism, but my hope for this book, first of all, I wrote it in the spirit of hope and optimism for the country. I recognize that a lot of people are very worried and are not very optimistic about the country, but I'm an optimist by nature and by experience.
Dan, let me ask you the irony of being encouraged to write this book about what unites the United States from social media, which has been so much the source of the divisiveness and the real polarization that Melissa spoke about. How do you put those two things together?
Well, not very well is the answer. It is ironic, and you make a very strong point. There is irony in that. But, you know, I feel so strongly that if people just stop, take a breath, lower their voice, and we talk to each other in a civil manner, which is gone a little out of fashion to talk with civility anymore, and if we remind ourselves what has brought our great country to this point, and particularly, and I do want to emphasize this point as I do in what unites us, the difference between patriotism and nationalism. These two things are not mutually exclusive, but there is a difference between patriotism and nationalism. The biggest difference is patriotism does have an element of humility. Patriotism, true patriotism is, listen, I love my country, I know my country's great, but we don't go around beating our chest about it. We try to learn from other people. We try to have respect for other cultures. Mm-hmm. Nationalism goes a bit the other way. There's a strain of arrogance in nationalism, particularly extreme nationalism, mm-hmm. which can be dangerous because it leads extreme nationalism can lead to nativism and then descend into tribalism. Mm-hmm. And if we ever reach the point in this country where we descend into tribalism, then we'll have a different kind of country. Again, I'm not preachy about it. I just want to remind people that that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned a minute ago, you feel that we're at a dangerous inflection point in this country. But when you look at those trends, overall, though, your book is optimistic. You focus on the things that bring us together rather than the things that tear us apart.
I do.
It's a hopeful book.
It is a hopeful book, but a realistically hopeful book, recognizing that, look, we've got challenges. We are being tested. We're being tested as to what our future is going to be. But I'm so convinced that if we just remind ourselves that we Americans agree on much more than we disagree. And frankly, and I say this gently, but I'm tired of hearing all these voices frequently from political leaders who are trying to further divide us along lines of race and religion and ethnicity. I'm so tired of hearing these voices of division, which they say these things and they do these things to divide us because they think it's to their partisan political and or ideological advantage.
Dan, let me ask you, you've seen America at some of its most divisive moments. You covered the civil rights movement in the early 1960s in Mississippi and in Georgia and Alabama. You covered Vietnam, of course, domestically as well as internationally. How do you think today's division compares?
Well, today's divisions in some ways compare, but I'm glad you raised the point because by raising that point, you remind us we've been through some really difficult times in the past. The 1960s, which you mentioned, they were a terribly divisive time. We had race riots in the streets, assassinations of leaders. The war was divisive. And, of course, we had the catastrophic civil war in the 1860s. So, you know, the historical perspective that I try to give is we've been through tough times before, and no ducking and dodging it. This is a tough time. But it's not any worse than some of the times we've gotten through before. However, we can't get through it by just wishing that we get through it, that we have to take action. And the most important action, of course, is get to the ballot box. Because for those people who feel like, you know, that we've made a mistake with President Trump, for those people, revenge is best served at the ballot box. And in the end, that's the single most important act people can take. But on a day-to-day basis, just reaching out and doing something, one thing each day to help some other person and help the community, is a brand of patriotism, because it helps the country.
And as someone who spent your storied career in media, in broadcast media, how do you think the media has performed its role as a watchdog through the election and now going into this presidential administration's first year?
Well, I want to make clear, when I say the media, I prefer the word press, but the media has made its mistakes. I've made my mistakes. That none of us, we're not perfect. But the answer to your question, I don't think that the press in general, including myself for that matter, did a very good job of its watchdog role during the nomination process. President Trump took full advantage. This is not a criticism of him, but he got a tremendous amount of free time, particularly on television, but also in print and radio, free time because he's a very good performer. And the media did not ask nearly enough tough questions or tough follow-up questions. And even during the election campaign, while it was somewhat better, not all that much better. However, since President Trump has become president, I do see signs that the media is doing a better job. There's been some really terrific investigative reporting done, all for the better, because that's one of the key roles the press plays in being part of our system of checks and balances on power.
So how can an American, Dan, become a better media consumer, a better consumer, an audience of the press?
I'm glad you asked, because it's a long list, but I'll try to keep it short.
Well, you're as a broadcaster.
In 30 seconds.
You've got 30 seconds, Dan.
All right. Number one, be skeptical but not cynical. Number two, try to get your news from different, a wide variety of channels and places. Don't get into a silo and just tune in or read something that agrees with your own prejudices and predilections. So be a wise consumer, and also try to find those places where people are doing quality journalism and actually doing reporting. So much of journalism today is actually entertainment, just posing as news.
Yeah, just talking, absolutely. But it has been a pleasure. Dan Rather has been with us here on the Florida Roundup. The name of the book is What Unites Us, Reflections on Patriotism. Dan will be at the Miami Book Fair on Sunday. Finally, in the roundup this hour, this is a deep sea dispute, Melissa. It's over a 16th century shipwreck, and it's right off of Florida's coast.
Yeah, this is interesting. A Florida court is hearing arguments over who gets the rights to some fascinating remains that have been on the seafloor near Cape Canaveral for hundreds of years, Tom. Debris from the ship includes several brass cannons. They're worth more than $1 million apiece, and a marble monument marked with the coat of arms of the King of France.
Pretty cool stuff here. Now, there's a marine salvage firm that has permits from the state of Florida to explore seven areas off the coast of Cape Canaveral. And this is the group that found these artifacts about a year and a half ago.
But late last year, the nation of France said, c'est moi. They're claiming ownership of the artifacts under what they're calling a sovereign right that prohibits the salvage of naval vessels without permission.
All right, So now the state of Florida, apparently, Melissa, is actually siding with the French, not the salvage firm that found the stuff. So I guess this will be a case of finders may not be keepers in regards to this 16th century shipwreck off of our coastline.
We'll have to see. Possession is 9/10 of the law, they say, but that is our program for today. The Florida Roundup is produced by WJCT Public Broadcasting in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Gina Jordan and Kevin Merschart are producers.
Jason Zabka is our technical director. Program director at WLRN is Peter Meritz. Our theme music is by Miami musician Aaron Libos. I'm Tom Hudson, and to our veterans, Melissa, thank you for your service to our country.
That's right. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening and calling. We'll be back next week.